Good morning. Go ahead and be seated. Okay, our first case on calendar this morning is docket number 64658, McDonald Corona Wilson versus Barassa Law Group. Are you ready, counsel? Okay, Mr. Cade.
Good morning, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. My name is Rory Kay, the law firm of McDonald Corona Wilson, the appellant in this matter. Justice Kagan, at this time, if I may, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my time for rebuttal purposes. Thank you. Your Honors, this appeal asks whether, under NRS 18.015, a withdrawing attorney has an enforceable charging lien that attaches to settlement funds later recovered by his or her former client. In entering its original order on this, the district court admitted that it was a very harsh order and answered that question in the negative, essentially holding that the case of Argentina v. Jolly Urga precluded a withdrawing attorney from enforcing his or her charging lien.
Counsel, the court understands 18, the particular statute. Was there anything in the fee agreement that indicated that if you withdraw, if there was no recovery by your firm, there wouldn't be any charges to the client? What was stated in that fee agreement?
There was not, Your Honor, and it did not expressly indicate what would happen with the fees in terms of withdrawal. Now,
why didn't you have that in your fee agreement?
That's a fair question, Justice Cherry. Admittedly, McDonald Corona doesn't do much contingency fee work, and so perhaps that was our fault on this matter. That said, the agreement is a standard form contingency agreement, and on its surface it does say that attorney fees shall be 40% of the gross amount recovered by settlement or judgment. Perhaps that provision in particular sets up the contingency upon which the firm can...
Well, how much do you want in the $55,000?
The fee is for 40% of the gross amount recovered by settlement, so that would be 40%. But, of course, that's always limited by the reasonable test in Runzel v. Golden Gate National Bank. And that's really what's issue. The issue here is that the district court never included that Runzel analysis, never reached the question of what was reasonable, because it simply held that under Argentina, McDonald could not assert an attorney's lien once it withdrew. Now, it focused exclusively on that case. It ignored the plain language of the statute, but more importantly, in our position, it ignored the case that resolves it all in the case that this court has always relied on when an attorney voluntarily withdraws, and that's the Earl v. Las Vegas Auto Parts case. That goes back to the 1950s, and that case already resolves the question of whether a withdrawing attorney can assert a charging lien against subsequent settlement proceeds. In the Earl case, the court affirmed a charging lien for a firm that was substituted prior to settlement, and then later asserted a charging lien against the recovered settlement. Now, it wasn't clear from the Earl decision whether or not the attorney withdrew or the client fired the attorney, but the decision, if nothing else, stands for the proposition that a charging lien lasts past termination of representation, that it can be attached to subsequent settlement proceeds. And we didn't include it in our briefing, but I do want to bring another case to the court's attention. I think it's important because it was actually decided after the Argentina case. And Justice Douglas, I believe you participated in it. It's the case of Shuck v. Signature Flight Services. The citation is 126 Nevada Advanced Opinion 42, 245 Pacific Reporter 3rd, 542. Now, again, that case was decided after Argentina. In the case, counsel withdrew and moved for a personal judgment prior to the client recovering a settlement. This court later overturned that personal judgment and said that the charging lien, the proper procedure was to assert a charging lien after the client had made some sort of recovery, be it by settlement or later judgment. And again, the case was issued after Argentina, and so if Earl isn't controlling, it certainly indicates and informs the analysis as to whether withdrawing attorney can recover and or attach their charge.
What was the reason you withdrew? McDonald Corona withdrew?
Well, that was an interesting point. McDonald Corona withdrew for good cause. The original court found that. And the reason was that the client and the attorneys just couldn't agree on settlement discussions with the defendant. And the relationship had reached a point where McDonald Corona no longer felt it could move forward with the representation.
My understanding is I believe the order was unopposed, or the motion was unopposed, right? So I don't know that that was, if there was a hearing on that, or it was just part of your briefing.
The underlying motion to withdraw, you're talking about, Your Honor? Yeah, and that was before I joined the firm, but I do understand, too, and I think I'm in agreement.
This would be probably the last order that would ever be unopposed in this jurisdiction if we were in your favor, because there won't be anybody who would appear. They'll all appear, and they'll say, I don't mind my attorney withdrawing, but I don't want him to take a part of the fee. I mean, this is, we're opening a can of worms here. And I think the judge that handled this was Judge Israel?
Correct.
And he was a PI attorney. In fact, he used to work for me when I was in private practice, and he did my PI stuff. You know, he looked at it, and I'm sure that over the years, this is a real controversy as far as I'm concerned. I think that we've got to be very careful how we handle this. I understand that you're entitled to something. There's no doubt in my mind that, you know, maybe some costs or something, but I just worry about if we say that you're entitled to go back and litigate this. I don't know. Oh, I can't wait to hear what the other side has to say in this matter, but I think that what's going to happen is I worry about unintended consequences if we say that a withdrawing attorney can come in and try to get 40% of the fee.
And I think under the court's precedent, the court has already made that holding through the Earl case and again later in Schott. Now, as to your question about the client appearing in an underlying motion to withdraw, I don't know that that's necessarily a bad thing in the sense that the trial court has more information as to why the attorney-client relationship has broken down and can make further factual and more complete factual findings.
Well, then it's going to be just like in the criminal setting where people, the people in jail always want to fire the public defender, and you have to have hearings and stuff. I mean, that's why I'm talking about unintended consequences. Civil litigation in this community has been very clean before, you know, in this state. We haven't had this problem, whereas in criminal, you have it constantly. People trying to fire their attorneys and attorneys trying to get off cases for whatever reason. I'm worried about what will happen if we come down in your favor. It has to be very tailored to make certain that everybody gets a fair share here.
Certainly, Justice Chair. And I think to your point, in this particular proceeding, the only consequence of note would have been that Justice Israel would have included McDonald Carano in his charging lien analysis in the
So you're saying as part of the mix, ultimately, if it goes back, there will be a determination based upon a hearing that takes place as to who gets what percentage and how much.
And that's essentially.
Not necessarily the fact that you're going to get 40%.
Correct. It's just that we would have been included in the analysis and Judge Israel could have moved to the Brunzell analysis as it applies to McDonald Carano. I think the other important point to Justice Cherry's question is that we also have to look at the spirit and policy that underlines the charge lien statute. In Barrow Walks v. the Law Office of Lugar and Pulver, the court, the Nevada Supreme Court, and I believe Justice Dennis wrote the opinion, noted that the statute has two particular purposes. The first is to secure the attorney's fees of the underlying attorney, but the more important point is to encourage attorneys to take cases of those who otherwise could not afford to litigate. In this case is a perfect example. If a withdrawing attorney could no longer assert a charging lien, then they would have to pursue a separate, more costly action under a breach of contract theory, under a theory of quantum merit, and then they're carrying the freight not only for the client in the underlying action, but now they're expending additional fees and costs prosecuting a separate action. And what that's going to lead to is you're going to see attorneys in the personal injury context, in the family law context, they're not going to want to take on financially risky clients because they know that if for some reason the attorney-client relationship breaks down and they have to withdraw or they're fired, they're not going to be able to recover their liens or they're not going to have the security an attorney's lien would provide. And certainly that cannot be an appropriate result under a statute that's designed to encourage more representation.
Can we differentiate between a contingent fee situation and an hourly fee situation with the withdrawing counsel?
Under the plain language of the statute, I don't know that it's possible to do so. The statute just says that the attorney's amount of the fee is any fee agreed upon or in the absence of agreement for the reasonable fee for the services. Now, if the court wants to
broad language.
Yeah, it is broad language. admittedly, and to the extent you wanted to do so, it's possible. And again, if the concern is the amount of fees, I think Brunzell takes care of that. Also, this court in its prior precedent has noted that under contingency fee agreements, the contingency still has to happen. So to the extent that the court's concern is with clients who are put out of ultimate recoveries, I think the court could fashion a distinction between contingency agreements and hourly fee agreements.
Was McDonald Corral contacted by the other side before they actually took the case? So-and-so's in my office, and I understand you had done some work on this case. I mean, that's what we used to do when the ball was much smaller. I know it's not possible now, but old as I am, and you go back 45 years of practicing law, in those days you just picked up the phone and worked it out.
Yeah, you know what? Actually, McDonald Corral came to know about the settlement and actually wrote a letter to the Barossa firm in advance of the underlying personal action case being dismissed. So I believe there was some contact between the two. Again, I wasn't around for the personal injury action. I just came in a pleader. But there was some discussion. Now, the question, though, is that the Barossa firm asserted in their initial motion that they were entitled to their full 40% for what amounted to about 6 months of work, but that McDonald Corano was only accountable or only could recover a pro rata share of this $55,000, despite the fact that McDonald Corano did the bulk of the work in the personal injury case. And so that's why, rather than settling it ahead of time between the attorneys that reached the interpleader stage, and of course you also have the medical providers and other parties who had a claim to this settlement fund. In fact, in the very first hearing, the Barossa firm stated that they didn't really have any interest in McDonald Corano recovery, that they were primarily concerned with their percentage of this $55,000.
Do you know what the medical liens were in this case?
I do not, Your Honor. I don't know the specific figure, I should say. I know that they definitely outstripped the $55,000. Now, the question is, the medical providers that were still remaining in the interpleader action, of course, this court got a letter later during the appeal suggesting that they weren't represented by local counsel. So from our perspective, that they wouldn't be part of the appeal, and perhaps they wouldn't even be part of the initial recovery on a pro rata basis. Because, again, and I don't know how the court has resolved that letter or where that went from there. But I have nothing else to say if the court has any questions.
You have 3 minutes and 24 seconds left.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Barossa, you ready?
Yes, Your Honor. Good morning. May it please the court. As a point of clarification, there is an attorney here from OASIS, and I don't know that he has time given to him or not, given his contribution was a joiner to our briefing, but we'd be happy to reserve a minute of our time for his use. With respect to this case, I think Justice Cherry hits it right on the point. This is a very, very dangerous precedent that's being asked by McDonald Corona Wilson.
And isn't the language fairly broad, though?
The language is fairly
so
broad.
So how do you keep it narrowly tailored?
I think first and foremost, you go back and you look at the statute, NRS 18.015, and you determine from that the lien in this instance is pursuant to the fee agreement between McDonald Corona Wilson and their client, or whoever the attorney is in this instance. And with respect to that, the court has already addressed that the McDonald Corona fee agreement is really, although it does have a provision for what happens should the client terminate services, does not contain a provision with respect to what happens should McDonald Corona Wilson withdraw. It does say that all costs incurred will be paid, but it leaves a very vague and open interpretation as to attorney's fees. The quote, I think, is attorney's fees shall be 40% of the gross amount recovered by settlement or judgment. And that precedent, if we were to accept McDonald Corona Wilson's representations here, is that we would have a situation where my firm steps in and we ask for our contingent percentage of 40%, that McDonald Corona Wilson steps in, asks for their contingent percentage of 40%, and their costs on top of that, and that exhausts the entire settlement, leaving both the client and any of the providers sued in the interpleader hung out to dry.
What were the meds in this case?
I believe that they exceeded $100,000, Your Honor.
And what about your firm's costs? How much did you guys have to put out?
Well, I actually had around $300 in costs. We don't dispute that McDonald Corona Wilson did a lot of work on the beginning of this case and put a lot of time and a lot of money into this case. But I'll represent to the court that this court has held in the, it's the Black and Labello case, Leventhal versus Black and Labello, that sometimes that happens. Sometimes you put a lot of energy, effort, and money into a case, and you get nothing. And in this instance, McDonald Corona Wilson elected to remove themselves from the case. So they knew at that juncture that there was a potential that the client didn't obtain new representation. They'd never recover their costs, and they'd recover no fee. In fact, that's the real concern here.
But counsel, by the ruling of the court, that took them even out of the cost issue as well.
I understand that, Your Honor. And as I said, we're not really disputing the fact that they expended funds, and we have no objection to them recovering those funds. In fact, we really don't have an opinion with respect to the fee, except for the part where if it impacts us. We take a lot of cases as second-look cases, as third-look cases. I've even had cases that were fourth-look cases. But if we were in a situation that I had to take into consideration that the recovery on the case has to fund not only my firm in terms of our efforts on a case, but two or three or even four other firms that are asserting liens on cases that they voluntarily dropped, we aren't taking those cases anymore because there's just no positive outcome to be had there. It creates a situation where the case is impossible to resolve.
Well, as you say that, Justice Sherry asked a question of counsel on the other side in terms of did your firm contact Donald Corona in terms of the issue of fees?
With respect to fees, Your Honor, no. We did not have a discussion with them with respect to fees. As soon as we were contacted by the client on the case, we did call their office and speak to them about the reasons that they dropped the case. They were cooperative the entire term of the case in terms of supplying us with the file without asserting a retaining lien on the file, and they were cooperative and open to discussion the entire time. We don't have any beef whatsoever with the behavior of McDonald Corona Wilson with respect to this case. We just have a very delicate issue of law.
Well, I ask you the question because if that's your position, then you take this subject to 18015, which is a little different than a holding in Argentina, which, with some loose language, talks about a lien on the judgment or settlement that the attorney has obtained for the client, which we have to read out in this particular case because of 18015.
And I think that's exactly the point. What we're talking about in terms of the statutory language and the language within the Argentina case.
But the statute, unfortunately, we don't get that kind of authority to make the statutes.
I understand.
We have to follow them.
But when we're talking about that, Your Honor, we're talking about whether that recovery is a present tense or a future tense or a past tense. And so when we talk about that an attorney has a lien on what they have obtained, that is present going backwards for the client, that's the draw line right there. That is the line in the sand. If they have not obtained something and they have voluntarily withdrawn from the case, they should be on notice that they're not going to recover a fee in that instance. Given this,
most of the case law that you've reviewed support that position?
I think most of the case law that we've reviewed is ambiguous to that position. We don't usually
see. I think you've cited three cases that support your position, and there's significant case law out there that goes the other direction.
There is on both sides.
How many other cases other than the three that you cited did you find that supported your position?
In the state of Nevada?
No, generally.
Generally speaking, I think we've cited four or five in our brief.
I know. Okay.
With respect, I think that McDonald Crown Wilson has cited to four or five opposing. This is an issue of first impression with respect to a withdrawing firm where it is definitive that they withdrew, asserting a lien after that fact. And that brings up another issue, Your Honors, and that is in terms of policy. What's to prevent a firm signing up a case, holding on to it for a few months, deciding it looks a little too tough for them to work up, and then dropping the case and asserting a lien on the case for their full contingent amount, having the case then go to another attorney, having the case go to another attorney, and piling on like that. I think it sets a very dangerous precedent where firms would be, in fact, encouraged to drop difficult cases because they would still get paid even if they didn't finish the case out.
What do your contingency fee agreements look like?
Typically, my contingency fee agreements?
Withdrawing provisions addressing withdrawing before the case is resolved.
Sure. We address it by saying, in the event of the termination of our firm, we don't make a distinction as to who terminates the services. In addition to that, we calculate our fee based on a contingency percentage and an hourly rate for the value of our services. And so we're able to quantify, should we be in a situation like this, or in a motion for fees with the court or whatever the issue is, we're able to quantify down to the one-tenth of a billable hour how much time and effort we've spent on the case versus trying to make a determination in quantum merit as to what the valuation of our efforts would be. So our fee agreement specifically states that we're going to have a percentage recovery or an hourly rate, and that in the event of the termination of our firm, that we're entitled to the greater of our fees in that situation.
Now, Judge's rule has not made final decisions in this at all as to the interpleader. Is that correct? Just about McDonnell-Carano, or what's happened?
Judge's rule made a final decision on the case after the hearing, the rebriefing, the rehearing, I think the rebriefing, and then the final hearing, wherein he denied McDonnell-Carano's Wilson's application for fees and costs entirely, and then provided for the Barossa firm to receive its full fees and costs and then a pro rata distribution of the remaining settlement funds among the medical providers and other lien claimants.
Has the funds been dispersed?
No. They've been held pursuant to Judge Israel's instruction in our trust account for the entirety of this case.
So we should send him a thank you note for that, for giving this grief to us.
I think it's the situation is what it is. It's a unique issue with respect to a withdrawing firm.
Let me ask you this, just out of curiosity. If the meds were $100,000, how did this case settle for $55,000?
This is a difficult case, Your Honor, and I don't want to speak to McDonnell-Carano's relationship with the client, but that ultimately, in a point of candor, resulted in a malpractice action by the client, to which I know nothing about. I didn't participate in, and didn't represent the client past the resolution of this case. But ultimately, there were some real problems in this particular case, and we had a firm sit down with the client to explain the situation, and he made a decision at that juncture that he didn't want to proceed with the case and accepted the $55,000 offer.
And the client's received no money to date?
The client has received none of the settlement proceeds, Your Honor. In fact, he's waived his right to the settlement proceeds with the understanding that after fees, costs, and the medical providers were paid, he was going to receive nothing anyway. And so he was essentially not going to invest any more of his time in this case. Well, McDonnell-Carano and I, I'm sure, have spent more than 100 hours each reaching this level.
What would you like us to do in this case? What's your bottom line?
I think ultimately, just as a matter of public policy, this court needs to issue a ruling that clarifies that when a firm presents a client on a contingent matter with no other provisions in their contract to address this situation, that they take the case as it is, and if they back out of the case during the pendency of litigation, they walk away from their fee. They've agreed to take the case and be paid by the recovery they obtained.
What about costs? Should they apply the costs too?
In this particular instance, their agreement indicates the client's responsible for the costs either way. I believe the costs should be part of the interpleader. I don't have an objection to that, and I've never stated an objection to that in the underlying case. They put out good money.
But the judge denied it already, so.
He did, Your Honor, and I don't think it would be inappropriate to remand the case based on that issue. just to settle out whether or not this court believes that by walking away they're entitled to costs. But ultimately, I think that the statute identifies that the fee agreement between the attorney and the client is what controls the situation. The fee agreement lacks any provision to address the situation on fees with them backing out of the case. The fee agreement does, however, address the cost situation. So
if we were to consider the statute ambiguous and look at the legislative history, does that support your position?
I would be surprised if you'd consider the statute ambiguous. It's very broad.
Obviously, there's a conflict here.
There is a conflict here, and the conflict isn't, I don't think, the statute. I think the conflict is the missing provision within the fee agreement of the attorney. The problem there is that the statute also states that in the event that there is no fee agreement, no written fee agreement with the client, that then you're going back to a quantum merit analysis.
Well, that brings up a good question from a policy standpoint and just a matter of efficiency and looking at the statute. They certainly would be entitled to go file an action and claim quantum merit. And so as a matter of efficiency, wouldn't the lien be appropriate?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, in this instance, again, it's not my argument to make, but McDonald, Carano, Wilson could certainly have asserted a counterclaim in the malpractice action. Whether they did or not, I'm unaware. But they could have engaged the client with respect to that either as an offset to any claim that was successful or as a separate claim in and of itself. And that is consistent throughout case law, including that Leventhal case, is just because you don't necessarily qualify for a charging lien, you still have full opportunity to pursue the client in other matters. You look like you're thinking of something, Justice.
Well, I'm thinking about we're making a decision in a case where the client's going to get no money. He sued the McDonald Carano for malpractice. The judge below figured that McDonald Carano was entitled to nothing. The med providers got a pennies on their dollars, I assume. I just the facts in this case are just overwhelming to me as far as a former person who did PI and who did the same thing, took second bites and third bites when. And on cases.
And I think that the same question would apply in a criminal matter. If you took a flat fee criminal case, you decided you didn't like your client because they wouldn't take what you thought was a spectacular deal and you wanted to back out of the case, are you still entitled to your full fee? Are you even entitled to back out of the case at that juncture? You just have to go ahead and try the case. That's really what
we would keep Justice Cherry in.
I would too. I don't think I can afford
it. When I was on the disciplinary committee, we had that exact issue on non-refundable fees for criminal cases. And luckily, I had people from Lionel Sawyer and the big firms, and they thought, well, $5,000 non-refundable fee, that's nothing. So we were able to sustain, you know, protect the criminal defense attorneys who did have non-refundable retainers when cases weren't even filed. In other words, somebody comes in your office, you get $5,000, and then the DA decides not to file. So well, this is bothers me a lot as to where we should go in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Kay, you've got 3 minutes and 24 seconds left.
Thank you, Justice Perry. I want to actually start with your question about what other jurisdictions are doing, because as we cite in our opening brief, the majority trend is towards permitting withdrawing attorneys to subsequently assert a charging lien against the settlement. We cited you cases from Massachusetts, New York, Colorado, Michigan, and New Mexico, but I can also tell you that the regional states around Nevada also permit recovery. And that really reflects the common sense notion that an attorney should be able to recover their reasonable fees in a case. And that's really all McDonald Carano is asking to do here. They're not asking to recover a windfall. We're not addressing a case where McDonald Carano came in, did a week's worth of work, kicked it down the road, and then said, give me all of my fees. We're approaching a case here where McDonald Carano basically did all of the activities in the personal injury action, from filing the case all the way through discovery, all the way up to pre-trial motion practice.
Here's the problem, to differentiate as to what you did in this case. But let's say that the Brazzo firm went to trial for a month on this case, and then you guys come in and try to get it, not your firm, but another firm. I mean, This, to me, is opening a can of worms. I'm really worried. What would you like our order or disposition in this case to say as far as McDonald Cronin is concerned?
What I would suggest, Your Honor, is that you overturn the district court's decision holding that McDonald Cronin no longer had a charging lien when they withdrew, and then just remand the case back to Judge Israel so that he can conduct the Brunzell analysis as to the reasonableness of the fees. Opposing counsel does make an interesting point that the modern trend towards litigation is for 3, 4, sometimes 5 firms to handle cases. The Brunzell analysis is perfectly appropriate for that type of situation, and I think we have to rely on district courts to be able to look at the evidence, look at which firms performed what work under that Brunzell analysis, and then issue fees or enforce liens based on that analysis. Two of the factors in Brunzell, the work actually performed and the results obtained, I think those two factors in particular are entirely appropriate to sort out these cases where there are multiple law firms participating.
But if we make it too sweet, it's going to kill our access to justice for people who have to, who are knocked out of a case by their attorneys, and then they go to a second attorney or a third attorney. They're not going to be able to get anybody to represent them because no attorney is going to take the case. I just worry about the unintended consequences here. That's what I'm concerned about.
Yeah, and I don't know that it would have changed Robert Cooper's position in this case to go to a second or third attorney. I mean, he was asserting his claims, and of course the opposite coin, side of that coin is true. If you tell the bar, that first position firm, that they can't recover if they have to withdraw, then you're essentially telling the firm that they have to do one of two things: never withdraw, which isn't permissible under the rules of professional conduct, or two, withdraw and incur all these costs prosecuting this separate contract action. And you're going to see firms respond in an unintended consequence by not taking financially risky clients, those very people that need the access to justice you talk about. And that's why I think remanding this back to Judge Israel so that he can sort out the various work done is the approach that gives the broadest amount of Nevadans access to justice while still ensuring that attorneys are able to recover whatever fees or costs they've expended prosecuting the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel, both for your excellent arguments and briefing the case. The matter will stand submitted. This is